there's sort of, I see two aspects of this issue in the business of war. There's sort of the high end, which is the big global weapons conglomerates, companies like Lockheed Martin, BAE, Boeing, and so forth. And they're all, of course, licking their chops to get a hold of their share of the $48 billion increase that the Bush administration has announced it's going to seek in military spending for this year, which will be the biggest increase since the early days of the Reagan administration. And it's one of the interesting things about that is a lot of it's not even for equipment that they're going to use in the war on terrorism. It's kind of just time for them to cash in. I mean, there's public support for high military spending, so they're going for everything. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal the other day about who would benefit in the defense industry, the weapons industry. They said basically everybody. And so there's that whole high end, which has a lot of tentacles in terms of lobbying. Lockheed Martin is a bigger political giver, for example, than Enron. There's executives from all these weapons companies in the Bush Pentagon sprinkled throughout the administration. But I think that story may be a little bit more well known. I mean, that's been happening certainly in the United States for years, and it has counterparts in Europe, certainly. But then on the low end of it, in terms of the less lucrative or the part that deals with small arms, civil wars, and so forth, how are they financed? That's really been pioneered by non-governmental organizations in the last 4 to 5 years. If you look there, you see, for example, a group like UNITA, which during the Cold War got aid from the United States to fight the government there in the name of anti-communism. In the 1990s, they were cut off from that aid. But they raised billions of dollars selling diamonds out of the parts of Angola that they controlled. And in fact, they raised about 10 times as much money through diamond sales as they'd ever gotten through aid during the Cold War. And they collaborated with middlemen, diamond dealers. The whole sort of distribution network for diamonds was in some way or another collaborating with that. And that method of financing war through plunder essentially exists in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, exists in throughout Asia, and as I mentioned, the Bin Laden network has sold diamonds. They've got sort of a corner on the market of a mineral called tanzanite, which is only found in Tanzania, which became a big favorite after it was featured in the movie version of the Titanic. That gross piece of jewelry that is featured was made out of tanzanite, and the prices apparently skyrocketed after that. So in any case, there's this kind of illicit or sort of hidden commerce in war that is certainly at a minimum facilitated and allowed to go on by the powers that run the current global trading system. And then there's the sort of more open funding of these big companies. And the two of them sort of came together in the war in Afghanistan, where you had the United States using its most advanced weaponry against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, who had basically weaponry that was probably 20 years old at best. Or if you look at the fact that, for example, the attack on the World Trade Center cost about $200,000, and the Bush administration, in response to it, is raising the military budget in this country by $48 billion. It's kind of, in a weird way, a David and Goliath story, not that either side is to be rooted for. So I think that's the main thing I wanted to say, is that there's this kind of dark underside of globalization, which really does facilitate warfare. And to the extent that countries are made almost incapable of providing a decent living for their people, decent education, and so forth, it further facilitates these kinds of wars, because a lot of the kids that are recruited really have no other options, in addition to the fact that some of them are coerced. If somebody's going to give them a gun, a structure to fit into, some place to stay, and food, that's already more than they're getting out of legitimate activities that are allowed to occur in their own countries, under the rules imposed by the IMF and the World Bank and the whole WTO system. So I think I'll leave it at that, and we'll turn to Tom for starters.
Thank you very much. My name's Tom Reichert, and I'm representing a group called Focus on the Global South. It's an honor to be here to talk with you today, and I look forward to having a dialogue about these issues. The terrorist attacks of September 11th are really a watershed event for those presiding over state corporate globalization from above and those resisting from below. The brutal slaughter of thousands of innocents in the U.S. is, of course, a major crime against humanity, which has no possible justification, and the people who carried it out have nothing in common with the struggles of oppressed people against the form of corporate globalization going on today. And yet, while apocalyptic and horrifying, the reality is that September 11th and the wars that have followed are a potential window into unveiling the dramatic transformations unleashed by neoliberal globalization and related processes of militarization. Because what we're witnessing today is a militarization of globalization discourse, as Davos men and other power elites argue that even more neoliberal programs and a greater diversion of resources towards military spending are necessary to counter terrorism. The unfortunate truth, however, is that in reality, U.S. and allied support for terrorism, which I'm defining very strictly as the deliberate targeting of violence against civilians to achieve political purposes, that, along with the imposition of neoliberal economic programs, which, however, are neither liberal nor new, have actually helped to create the dramatic polarization now undermining U.S. and global security. And while it's critical to point out that there are a host of non-economic motivations for the so-called war on terrorism, deeply rooted in contemporary culture, it is also a fact that economic globalization and militarization have long been intertwined. In fact, what I call the national security state corporate complex, denoting the fusion of private corporate power and public state bureaucracy, actually in this country goes back to centuries turn. It was this period in the late 19th and early 20th century that saw the birth of U.S. multinational firms and the expansion of U.S. state corporate power overseas. And in the late 19th century, as in the late 20th and the early 21st, I would say, military spending functioned both as a countercyclical economic mechanism, subsidizing U.S. corporate profits and high technology at home, while providing for military forces to project power and ensure an open door for U.S. capital abroad. In fact, it was in World War I, the kind of war collectivism of World War I, when dollar-a-year men took over the U.S. State Administration, that really became the model for the construction of U.S. hegemony on new and enlarged social foundations during the Great Depression, World War II, and the early Cold War. And in fact, though most people don't know it, it was during World War I when the godfathers of the U.S. establishment, such as Henry Stimson, led a war preparedness movement through volunteer military training and the formation of groups called the National Security League, even though most people think that national security is an ideology that only came about in World War II and the Cold War. And it was World War II as well that allowed the re-entry of these corporate dollar-a-year men into the U.S. state, leading to the New Deal's wartime transformation and partial liquidation, as core capital groups came to control the strategic cabinet posts dealing with foreign affairs, the military, and the macroeconomy. And it was after World War II when elites realized that military spending could be used to deflect the labor movement's ambitious plans for post-war social democracy by incorporating the labor movement as junior partners in U.S. expansion while simultaneously funding high-technology military industry. In fact, during the Korean War boom, when we really got the permanent war economy that we have today, the U.S. used what William Borden has called international military Keynesianism, or international military spending, to buy weapons and related supplies from Japan and Germany to rebuild those countries as the industrial workshops of Europe and Asia and integrate them in U.S. military alliance systems. Once again, military spending propped up state corporate power at home while providing the military means for what was really a global program of counter-revolutionary violence to maintain an open door for corporate capital abroad. And while U.S. officials said that they were promoting economic modernization and development, this nexus of state and corporate power actually put the U.S. on a path of opposing human rights, national sovereignty, and sustainable development in much of the third world. Hence, a litany of U.S. interventions, notably in the Middle East, where the U.S. put down secular movements for democracy and independence, ironically creating a very fertile context for the rise of political Islam that elites talk about as the great danger today, including, of course, supporting the Mujahideen and people like Osama bin Laden. The critical point, though, is that this set the U.S. on a kind of path-dependent process of militarization that we saw reinforced in the 80s and again today. but it also gave a huge shot in the arm to neoliberal globalization. For in the, by the late 1960s, the U.S. military and other governmental spending was so profligate that it had undermined U.S. control over the world monetary system and led to the financialization of the world economy that we saw today. And then, of course, there was the rise in oil prices and the nexus of payments for protection, whereby that money that was gotten through the oil price rises was funneled back into U.S. Treasury securities and into buying U.S. arms, whereby the U.S. also exchanged protection for these client and dictatorial states in the Middle East. As William Hartung and Michael Clare have analyzed, growing U.S. global arms sales to the Middle East became an increasingly important mechanism to prop up the U.S. balance of payments and regional balances of power at one and the same time. And this process vastly increased the power of those global corporate firms dependent on a variety of forms of military spending, especially as intensifying globalization and competition led U.S. firms to seek military subsidies at home and arms exports abroad to cope with this increased economic competition. Now, the tremendous amount of money that was generated from this vast expansion of military spending and other profits eventually, by the 1970s, really had nowhere to go. And meanwhile, the United States was increasingly in deficit. Now, this was around the time when Iran, which was a key client state of the U.S. and the Middle East, fell, and the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Now, in the 1980s, the U.S. doubled the military budget, but there was a critical difference in how it financed it. It financed it through regressive borrowing on the international capital markets and from the wealthy who were awash in Reagan's tax cuts. So the obverse side of this program of regressively financed militarization was really the devastation of the Third World and the devastation of the South that had borrowed money at high interest rates. And in fact, when people talk about international financial speculation and the rise of speculative capital, a good chunk of that came out of the marketing of $13.5 trillion in securities by the U.S. government to fund this incredible period of militarization. So what I'm essentially trying to argue here is that we really have to understand that the struggle for a peaceful world and the struggle for the peace movement to create real security is interlinked with the struggle against the form of globalization we have and absolutely necessary. In fact, noted economist Jagdish Bhagwati has argued that about the power of Wall Street in the world today, trying to explain why we see this emphasis towards greater capital mobility even though it's been such a disaster. And he says not only ideology but also interest have played a role for the simple reason that, quote, in the sense of a power elite a la C. Wright Mills, a definite networking of like-minded luminaries among the powerful institutions, Wall Street, the Treasury Department, the IMF, the World Bank, most prominent among them. This powerful network, which may aptly, if loosely, be called the Wall Street Treasury Complex, is unable to look much beyond the interest of Wall Street. And he goes on to say in another interview, just as in the old days there was this military-industrial complex, nowadays there is a Wall Street Treasury Complex because secretaries of state like Rubin come from Wall Street. And what I want to argue that it is true that we have this complex, and for a long time it's been part of a larger complex, which I call the National Security State Corporate Complex. In fact, if you look at the IMF and the World Bank, in the 1960s, along with the U.S., they really facilitated the overthrow of a lot of governments in the Third World. Why? The IMF demands that governments implement austerity. Lots of the population don't like that. Lots of democratically elected populist leaders don't like that. There were a number of cases when, faced with IMF austerity programs, there were military coups that established a regime which imposed austerity. And why was that important? Because that way the military can continue to get aid from U.S. elites and continue to get credit. So I think that that sets a context for understanding some of the developments we see today. I'll try to wrap up pretty soon here. Did this remilitarization of the world in the 1980s really increase our security? Well, no, I think we all know it actually undermined it. In fact, people who are studying the rise of political Islam have argued, as Paul Lubeck, head of a Carnegie Commission on the subject, has done, quote, triumphant neoliberal economic and social policies, to the chagrin of informed observers, became the midwife to Islamist ascent in civil society. Why is that true? Well, in Middle East, Islamic, and Arab worlds, the IMF and World Bank have been enforcing structural adjustment programs. this has led to devastating consequences in the state and devastating consequences for social subsidies. And as Islamist political movements, a lot of them, have taken over the language of the old secular left, much of which was destroyed, including with U.S. support. And so that's why Lubeck can say that these structural adjustment programs have been a, quote, ideological windfall like manna from heaven for these Islamist political movements. In fact, I think that at this point, the movement really needs to realize that this remilitarization we're seeing today, obviously there are some serious security threats in the world, including to the U.S. now. But I think that what some of us on this panel would try to organize is that if we looked at the policies that the U.S. has taken to deal with this, we find like a lot of quote-unquote U.S. security policies, they have nothing to do with security. They don't increase our security, they decrease our security, and they do so in a way by propping up corporations. There's another critical part of that. The mythology that we hear about so much of today is the free trade and the free market. But I think that what we increasingly see is that those have been elaborate myths, and they've been myths to justify the utilization of violence and state power on behalf of vested interest. You know, Boeing is very explicit about this. It's one of the reasons that I have sympathy for Boeing, because they're very explicit. They say, we need this military money as a counter-cyclical economic mechanism because we're in a very cyclical industry. Now, if Boeing is saying that the public has to support Boeing, then that raises a lot of very dangerous democratic questions. If we're paying for the commercial aircraft industry, if we're paying for Boeing, then maybe we should exercise some control over that corporation. The final thing I want to say in this, because it's not only about vested interests, although that's important too. Karl Polanyi, in his brilliant work, The Great Transformation, argued that the very notion of the self-regulating market is in fact a stark utopia. And what he argued that everywhere in the late 19th century, and I think again today, where you saw the rise of the self-regulating market, you saw counter-movements for the self-protection of society. And in fact, along with vested interests, that also applies to corporations. The reality is that boom and bust cycles in economies and basically operating a complex society on the market alone doesn't work. That's why corporations want public subsidies of private profit through taxpayer spending. Elites have long sought to use military spending and nationalism, as A.J. Musty pointed out long ago, as their own form of self-protection against the vagaries of the market system. And I think that today we face a real challenge. If you look in the third world today, especially in countries like South Asia, which I've been visiting a lot this summer, they are totally militarized societies. And they see a leader in the global system, the United States, that is also pushing towards militarization. One of the leading voices in the human development movement, Mahbub al-Haq, who died a number of years ago, made this point very explicitly, that if we're to build a just world, we have to transfer the tremendous amount of resources that we spent on militarization, not only in countries like the U.S., but also in countries like Pakistan and India that spend roughly $20 billion a year on the military. We need an alternative project development that links up the struggle with peace for a struggle for a just world. And I look forward to being in that battle with you for a long time to come. I think it's a really critical time in U.S. and world history. And I was very heartened by the protest yesterday, because I think we've regained some of the momentum that was lost after September 11th. Thank you very much.
So Tom did another thing that they're not doing at the Waldorf, which was look at history. And I think there'll be a lot to talk about afterwards. So Emily Hayfield, am I pronouncing your last name?
Emmy,
who is the director of Friends of the Earth in Indonesia, will talk about how the business of war has played out there.
Thank you. I am very, how do you call it, shocked listening to Tom's speech, and I just understand how within 32 years, Suharto was, perpetuated by international donors and by the wars that were created to our country by transnational companies. And I have papers, but I realized that my papers was not stapled very correctly by the photocopy machine. So I took it back. So for those who have my papers, it was completely wrong. So I'm so sorry about that. So I will give this my papers later. The title of my papers is Sustainable Livelihood and Peace, Not Wars and Not Militarization. This come out of the experience that we have in Indonesia for 32 years under military dictatorship of Suharto. When Suharto took over the power in Indonesia in 1967, in 1965, and we know now openly through the documents that just came out public to public in the last 2 years that those coup d'etat was supported by CIA. We had the experience that a very rapid transition from a closed economy into a open market and foreign direct investment. And I would like to focus on two of the most controversies of investments that came out of cooperations between Suharto and CIA. Mining, copper and gold mining company investment in West Papua in 1967. Right after Suharto was installed by the Indonesian People Assembly at that time, it was crudely manipulated. And, you know, as I think it was the first foreign direct investment in Indonesia. It was large. It was even West Papua at that time was under the United Nations, supervision. West Papua was not under jurisdiction of Indonesia at that time. So that investment has created a lot of conflict since then, from the local people to the creation of the Free Papuan organizations, the organizations that maintain the movement to free in West Papua from the Indonesian occupations. That's how they stated their objectives. And the environmental degradations created by the investment is huge. I'm from the environmental movement, and the human right abuses following it was also very brutal. We know from the publicly widely distributed National Human Rights Commission report that killings, disappearance, torture, and rape took place between 1974 to 1996 in this area. And since then, since 1980s, mid-80s, the West Papua then was declared as a military operation area, so the DOM. And the rulers of this province was the Indonesian army, and mostly the Indonesian's army special forces. So then the next, at the other end of Indonesia, I'm taking out the stories of East Timor because everybody knows and the solution is there. But these two conflicts are still there at the moment. The west end, the other end of Indonesia in Aceh, one of the first foreign direct investment under Suharto was the ExxonMobil oil and gas exploitations. This was taken place in a very small town, Lok Semawe or Arun, of the strictly Muslim society, a very close society, and did not have the West Papuan people did not have a intensive relationship with outsiders. The ExxonMobil and Bechtel build the Los Maui into an industrial complex and brought with them all this industrialized culture, workers, prostitutions, alcoholic, bars, cafe, nightclubs, to this very close society. And also that the industrial complex took over the land from the local people by force without adequate compensations. The same story in West Papua. So these two investments were like, how do you call it, enclaves of economy. In Los Maui, inside Mobil Oil, at that time still is not still, it was not Exxon Mobil, it was like small California, if I can, or small Texas maybe, you know, with full with, you know, luxurious and developed world countries, while outside this enclave, people are still living, still live in a very basic conditions. The same thing in West Papua. So there is a huge gap, inequality between income, there's injustice, there was, how do you call it, a cultural gap. The everything took place in these two areas. In 1980s, late 70s, the local clergy then became, how do you call it, uneasy with this situation. They started to protest and created the so-called the Free Aceh Movement, the GAM. The Free Aceh Movement took an armed struggle against the Indonesian government because of the problems that was created in Los Maui, and Los Maui actually becomes the stronghold of GAM at that time. Aceh then also was declared as the military operation areas. A lot of environmental problems occurs in this area. Frequent fires from the oil and gas refinery took place. A lot of pollutions from the sludge, oil sludge, that were dumped into the ground. They have a ground compoundment there. Spilled over to the rice field of the local people. You know. The local people had to be relocated or evacuated frequently because of the fires of the oil and gas. So many things that they had to endure. And Aceh also was declared as military operation areas, and we know in 1998 that there were brutal, I can't even express it, very brutal treatment of the Army Special Forces to the women, to the children, and to the people of Aceh. We at that time realized that there many of the Acehese men have left the countries, went abroad, and only women and children were left in the villages around that areas. And we also knew that women were tortured, were naked, were raped, and were hanged upside down just to get the information about GAM. In 1998, when Suharto stepped down, this all came out to the Indonesian public, because before, we didn't know that happened. The Indonesian press was controlled tightly by Suharto. We knew it, some of us, because we in the movement knew what happened, but mostly the Indonesian people, they didn't know. So the Indonesian people then demanded that the government stop this kind of operations. And in 1999, I think the military operation area of these two countries, two provinces, were then revoked. But the government failed to discipline the military. The problem is still there, and the military still operates in the same way. And the most recent tragedy was the killing of the Thais Eluai, the president of the West Papuan Congress, allegedly done by the Special Army Army Special Forces, and his drivers also disappeared from that. When we try in Aceh now, the army is reinstated. The new the army territory commander that was revoked 2 years ago now is reinstated. Why? Because ExxonMobil stopped operations, I think late 2000 or early 2001, and because they said they couldn't cope with the security problems. So the government then sent the troops, the army troops, back to protect the ExxonMobil complex, and now they started to operate again. And because of that, now the areas is called the law and orders operation, yeah, and not military operation area, but the law and orders. But they have a lot of police arm, the mobile brigade of police, and the new army is coming into Aceh. The same thing in West Papua. When we tried, when the Indonesian people requested the government of Indonesia to correct these mistakes that were done in the past, the government at that time, the previous president, tried to amend the contract of work to Freeport Indonesia and also the concessions to the ExxonMobil. But they couldn't do that, because the companies backed by IMF, the World Bank, and also the US government refused and resist that the move to amend the contract of work to include more about land rights, about human rights and environmental responsibility. So we end up now with the conflicts unresolved, and with companies refuse to take part in any of this conflict resolutions that we have since Suharto. These are only two most example of the problems that was created by transnational companies in Indonesia: environmental degradations, human rights abuses, and things like that. So now, with after September 11. New Indonesia has been targeted as one of the, you know, the radical Muslim countries, among others, together with the Philippines, southern Philippines, and Iraq, and Iran, and other places. You know, there some Indonesians are now in jail, and we don't know why, whether they are part of the Osama bin Laden or not, the Al-Qaeda. But I would like to share with you that social injustice and inequality are the fertile field, the fertile ground for violence and radicalism. Yes, we have a lot of problems with ultra-right-wing Muslims who are trying to capture the opportunity of the difficult times now that we are facing in our transition into democracy, and trying to gain ground for that. But we are trying to stabilize our fragile democracy. It's not easy. We have to deal with so many problems that we receive from Suharto era. We are the largest Muslim society in the world, the largest Muslim democracy right now in the world. We cannot fail. If we fail, the democracy is at stake. But to enable us to succeed, it's not wars that we need. It's sustainable development. I am very much disturbed by speech or
rhetoric
that the official development aid is tied to terror, anti-terror activities. Yeah, it means it will bring military back to our country while we are trying to get rid of them. You know, by this the new wars against terror, it means military will gain ground. And I think there are only two choices. Then I will give these choices to those who are now at the World Economic Forum. That if we want to bring peace to the world, and the answer is to bring sustainable livelihood, bring justice, bring equality, and bring democracy. And we need that. We need sustainable development, which have three pillars: economic, social, and environment, and not wars. For those companies who invest in Indonesia, I would like to call that while the Indonesian peoples are struggling to build our democratic system, you too have to participate in the country's transitions to democracy and sustainability. You cannot walk away from the mess that you created together with Suharto's regime. You have responsibility to resolve the problem that we have and cannot leave the matters only to the Indonesian government. In this case, these companies have two choices: be protected by the democratic mechanisms or by the military. If the latter one that you choose, then you will meet a strong resistance by the Indonesian peoples and more terrorists. New business of wars have to be translated into the business of answering to the people's demand. That is the only way to bring peace to the world. And we beg the people of America to be the agent of bringing peace with sustainable livelihood than to bring war to poor countries. We beg you to turn your anger and sadness into more productive way to bring justice, equality, and prosperity in poor country rather than bringing wars to our poor countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Emmy. One of the people who was pontificating over at the Waldorf is Paul Wolfowitz, who's probably the most right-wing member of the Bush administration. He's a deputy defense secretary. I'm sure he was involved in crafting this language of the axis of evil, and is one of the Bush advisors who really thinks they should just wage war without end, and that they're the ones who get to decide who the terrorists are, so that when the United States takes actions that kill civilians or arms death squads, of course, they will just define that as not being terrorism.
He was the ambassador to Indonesia in the 80s.
And he was the ambassador to Indonesia in the 80s, and he was quite active in the U.S.-Indonesia Business Council, which has worked very hard to keep some of these arrangements that Emmy described in place. And under the rhetoric of the war on terrorism, the Bush administration is moving to try to step up arms sales and military and police training to Indonesia, which had been restricted by an international movement based on solidarity with people in Indonesia and on the record of human rights abuses of the Suharto regime and the Indonesian military in the post-Suharto period. So I think Emmy gave a good case study of how this whole anti-terror effort is fundamentally anti-democratic and is going to be used to try to set back the struggle for global justice that a lot of us are here to talk about and to try to advance. But we're going to hear now from Irene Khan, who I believe is the International Secretary for Amnesty International, is that correct? And then if none of our other speakers come, we'll launch into the questions, and if anybody else comes, we'll just throw them into the mix when they get here. Irene.
Thank you. I'm Secretary General of Amnesty and very new. Yes.
Is it okay?
Yes.
Maybe just a little closer.
Yes. I'm rather new to Amnesty International, to this particular post. I took up my assignment in late August, just a few weeks before the tragedy that happened here in the U.S. And in that sense, I was thrown headlong into the whole debate about security and human rights and off the deep end. So it was a sink or swim situation, and I don't know yet which way things are going. What is very clear, and I know it from my own background, I come from Bangladesh, a country which is very poor, a country which is racked with political violence. I have worked with human rights NGOs in the past and with refugee organizations. So I have seen the outcome, the failure of human rights and what the consequences are when people are forced to flee their homes. And from that perspective, what is very clear to me is that stability built on repression is always false. And also that security, the notion of security, has to have a comprehensive approach. You cannot put into boxes the different types of security. What you have to do is you have to start looking at what you want to achieve, and what you want to achieve at the end of the day in anything that we do in this world is human security. And human security has many dimensions to it that go far beyond the security debate that is taking place today. And in a sense, the catastrophic events of 11th of September have some parallel with what is now happening with Enron. Enron in the economic world and 11th of September in the political and human world have, I think, shown us a number of things. First, the vulnerability of so-called systems that are in place, and that vulnerability actually exposes the biggest victims are ordinary people. It also shows us the dichotomy, the dangers that happen when there is isolation rather than acknowledgement of interdependence in our world. And it shows us that the path ahead is through interaction and not exclusion, and that we need a much more responsive approach to the economic and social problems that plague us today if we are to approach the political problems. And this is why I think it is very appropriate that there should be two fora at the same time, the World Social Forum and the World Economic Forum. What is, however, very unfortunate is that there is no bridge linking the two fora. How can you seek to build prosperous societies if you forget those who make up those societies? I think that is the question that we need to ask. And this is why, while I'm here in New York at the World Economic Forum, the head of Amnesty's International Executive Committee, who is the head of the governing board, is actually now in Porto Alegre. So we want, and the two of us are carrying the same message, and our message is twofold. First, that human rights are indivisible, that is, political and civil rights and social, economic and cultural rights cannot be compartmentalized. They are indivisible and we must uphold them as a complete whole. And secondly, that we will hold all actors that have influence and responsibility for human rights accountable for their action. And that includes not just governments, but, and increasingly so, the corporate actors. So with those introductory comments, let me then move into what I was going to speak today, and that is the threat that we are confronting today in our human rights work in Amnesty. We believe that security is best provided when governments and corporations fully respect the standards of international human rights and humanitarian law. Because human rights are not only the means of securing the rights of individuals, they actually provide a framework for accountability. Because if you don't have that framework for accountability, then you will not have the rights. And that is what is missing, I think, in this process of globalization, is the framework for accountability is way behind the speed with which globalization is proceeding. And we need to turn on its head all this debate about security and human rights as though they are diametrically opposed objectives. They are not. Human rights are not an obstacle to security. They are actually very often the key to security, because in societies which respect human rights of the people, those tend to be societies which are stable and secure. And we know that we are. We've just heard our colleague from Indonesia talk about Indonesia. We know when we look around the world what happens when you violate human rights. You don't build secure societies. You build a false sense of security which will only last like a bubble and then blow with disastrous consequences. And this is why we are worried in Amnesty International that whereas there is this demand to increase security in the aftermath of 11th September, there is not the same consciousness among the leaders of the world that an individual security is most often threatened by the state. State and non-state actors both affect security. And they are not always necessarily, of course, here in New York, you witnessed at first hand the terrible acts committed by a non-state actor. But there are others in other parts of the world that are also daily facing the violations, the human rights violations of non-state actors. And we have not yet been able to devise a system of responsibility and accountability that effectively brings them on board. And I'm now talking about the corporate world. There are restrictions. I think the other thing that we must remember in this time of crisis is that there is always a bottom line. And it is not a financial bottom line that I'm talking about on an accounting sheet. What I'm talking about are certain basic, fundamental, universal values. And if those values are not preserved in times of crisis, it is in fact in times of crisis that one needs to hold on to those values even more, because that is what will help us to get out of crisis. And of course, from Amnesty's perspective, those moral values are values based on the equality of all human beings to enjoy all human rights. Invoking national security to cut back on human rights is not a new phenomenon. We've seen it before. Amnesty has monitored the use of security laws and measures in all regions of the world for the past 40 years. We have seen it in the 70s, in Latin America, in Argentina, in Chile. We have seen it in South Africa, in the apartheid era. We have seen it in countries like Turkey, UK, and Spain in Western Europe. We've seen it in India, in Kashmir, and Northeast. We see it now in the Middle East, in Israel, and the occupied territories. So these are not new, yet it seems that we have forgotten the lessons of history as governments go headlong, jump on the bandwagon of anti-terrorism, without examining whether the current framework that we have of human rights, whether that is an adequate and of international criminal law and of international criminal justice, whether these are not the things that we need to hold on as we move forward and strengthen the International Criminal Court, participate in the international system of justice rather than creating a shadow criminal justice system which actually undermines human rights. There has been no scrutiny of where security went wrong, but everyone, governments, seem to know what the answers are. The draft laws are coming out very rapidly from the drawers without examining to see whether they are really needed in the first place. And what has been very worrying for us is that the global impact of this war against, so-called war against terrorism, is being ignored. And the global impact, what's happening around the world, is that the so-called war against terrorism is actually being used as a license to cut back on civil liberties or to clamp down on political dissent. And if you have visited the Amnesty website, or if you haven't, I would invite you to visit it, and you will find the long list of countries that we have monitored where we have seen this backlash, where Egypt, they banned Islamist groups and have increased the number of people that have been sent to military trials, trials that are so obviously unfair that you wonder whether that is the way in which they will find those who are really culpable. So it doesn't even meet the security needs Not only is it terrible for those innocent people, but it doesn't even meet the security needs. Look at China. The Chinese government has very openly said it makes no distinction between separatism, terrorism, peaceful opposition, or dissent. For them, it's the same thing. In India, the Prevention of Terrorism Ordinance has been introduced, which actually gives impunity to police, government, army officials, paramilitary forces, for any action that they take in so-called good faith. In Malaysia, the government is using this excuse to now tighten up the Internal Security Act, which will allow them to further restrict the political opposition. And I could go down that line. In Zimbabwe, the government is claiming that journalists are actually terrorists because they report on the political opposition. We'd hear no condemnation from the powerful governments of this world on these actions. Why? Because they are all partners in the so-called global coalition against terrorism. And no one is even questioning the use of the word terrorism in these contexts. What is terrorism? Now, Amnesty International doesn't like that word, and we don't believe, whenever we use it in our documents, we put quotations around that word, because there is no common international objective definition of terrorism. It simply depends on where you're standing as to who is a terrorist, because it's always that kind of violence that you don't like that is terrorist. And if you like that kind of violence, then you justify it as a liberation war or as some other kind of legitimate use of violence. For us, what must happen is that we must go back to objective standards of human rights and international law. No cause can justify the violation of human rights, regardless of whether they are committed by governments, by armed political groups, by religious fundamentalists, by international criminals, or by corporate actors or other non-state actors. And if we allow our human rights priorities to change with political and economic interests of powerful states, what we are allowing to happen is actually an undermining of the universal values of human rights. In today's world, what we see is the globalization of the economy, but the fragmentation of the social world because of exclusion. What can bring us back together, I think, is a common commitment to some universal values that put the human person up front. And that was the objective of the human rights movement when it first started in the aftermath of the Second World War. I think that was the lesson that was learned after the Second World War, that human rights are global values, are universal values. And we need to bring back the debate there if we want to bring together the world, rather than talking about the clash of civilizations or the clash of religions. I was on a panel yesterday where they were talking about Islamist terrorists. And I had to stop and remind them, well, in the US, you did have another attack as well. And that was committed by an American, Timothy McVeigh, killing American lives. So let's not do this racial profiling whereby we exclude people, whereby we encourage collective punishment, whereby we actually encourage more xenophobia, more racism, more hatred, more division, more exclusion. So we have to move back from that to the fundamental values, back to the basics in a sense. And the basic value is, how do we protect best the human being? And human rights protection is for the best of us and the worst of us. If we treat people like animals, then they might well behave like animals. So let us not be surprised about that. And that is why Amnesty has taken the position it has done in the context of Guantanamo Bay, that we believe the international standards of international humanitarian law applies to everyone, and governments must uphold them. In the same way, we are arguing now that it's not just governments, it's those who have power and influence. Those who exercise power must also be held accountable for the responsibilities that come with power, and that applies to the corporate world. In this globalized economy, the corporate world is beginning to exercise public power. It is exercising, it's enjoying public benefits. And it cannot stay away then from responsibility for public affairs. And that is for human rights. You cannot take and not give. And you have a responsibility, legal and moral responsibility, as corporate actors. That's the message that we are giving at the World Economic Forum. Whether it's getting through, of course, is another matter. But it's not only in the World Economic Forum that we need to get that give that message. I think we need to give it in every possible way. And that is why I have been very impressed with both the presentations that I've heard at the public eye here, because they have depth, they have analytical value, and they have sensitivity to issues that are not being discussed in that forum. In that forum, what matters is the label, who you are, not what you say, and even less what you do. And we have to bring the debate back to what do you actually do. It is no good for CEOs to sign papers saying, yes, we are responsible social citizens and we have corporate social responsibility. What they have to do now is they have to show by their action what is happening within their spheres of operation, but also beyond the spheres of operations in the communities in which they operate, because they do have extremely powerful roles to play, particularly in poor countries like mine, where otherwise what we find is governments hiding behind companies and companies hiding behind governments. And we've just got to stop that. And we've got to align, bring them back at the same table at the same time together with civil society. And unfortunately, there isn't a forum. There isn't a forum that actually brings those two actors effectively enough. The UN is trying, but I don't think the Global Compact is strong enough, needs to be strengthened if it's really going to be an effective compact. And it certainly doesn't happen in the World Economic Forum because of the exclusion mentality that they have failed to overcome so far. I think what we need, I think in what the human rights framework provides is a framework for equity and accountability. Because at the end of the day, I heard about Indonesia where people are being excluded. In my own country, in Bangladesh, there is also a sense of exclusion. And there is a deep sense of injustice. I have been traveling since 11th of September. I've visited Lebanon. I went to Pakistan. I met with Afghan refugees. I traveled to the Afghan border, met with a lot of women, a lot of community leaders, Afghan community leaders, NGOs, and others in Pakistan. I traveled to Bangladesh. And everywhere what I see is a deep sense of injustice. And unless justice is defined, and we have said, Amnesty, in reacting to the events of 11th of September, we call for justice because we believe every victim deserves and demands justice, but not revenge. But justice must also be defined more broadly to include not just legal justice. We are not just talking about bringing people to court and prosecuting them. We are talking about building a deeper sense of social justice. And unless we can move and recognize and accept that broader concept of social justice, I'm afraid that we will fail to meet the demands and the growing demands of the people out there. At one of the roundtables in the World Economic Forum, I was sitting with some corporate CEOs and others around the table, and one of them was talking, and of course the whole discussion was, well, you know, there's a gloomy picture in the world, well, how do we go ahead, what do we do? And there was one CEO who said he came from Silicon Valley, and how the strength of the Silicon Valley is to build growth and speed and timeliness, and they will surely overcome this depressing global outlook, and they will produce, and they will do great things. So I had to put my hand up at that stage and say, excuse me, I come from another valley, and that is called Sylhet Valley, and that is in the north of Bangladesh. It's one of the poorest areas of one of the world's poorest countries. And in that valley, there are girls who are lucky if they can go to school and who are luckier still if they don't die in childbirth. And the speed and the growth that this CEO was talking about in Silicon Valley doesn't touch their lives. And unless some of it touches the lives of people like that, we will not, in an interdependent world, we be able, in the end, to build prosperity in one part of the world and leave it unaffected. I think those are the lessons that we have to learn from tragedies. I think we learn from the tragedies of our personal lives, and we have to learn from the public tragedies of the kind that happened here in this city. How we bring on board those who are excluded and those who are out. This is not in any way to justify violence. There is no justification for violence. There is no justification for human rights violations. But one needs to understand the schism that is developing in the world and how we close that schism if we don't want ourselves to be swallowed by it. Thank you.
Okay, we have a little more than 45 minutes, so let's launch into questions and comments. If you want to make a comment, you know, try to keep it to a minute or two so that we can include as many people as possible in the discussion. Oh, and there's...
Please come to the microphone over here to make the question.
An important logistical note.
Talk to you later about the security stuff you're doing, because we want to monitor that too.
I have a question.
Why don't people tell us who they are and if they're with an organization or something?
My name is Chris Muth. I'm independent. Not with an organization, even though my father worked for the CIA, for AID, for the UN Development Program, and I was born in Africa and spent 16 years in Africa and the Middle East. He also worked for the FAO. I'm familiar with the international context personally, as well as by osmosis. And my question is, I've been to Costa Rica, and I'm in love with Costa Rica. Costa Rica is a little place, and when they had a civil war, and the president refused to step down when he lost an election, there was a revolution led by a professor, Don Pepe, of the university. It lasted 3 months. They overthrew the military, and then they were the first country in the world to ban their own military, and to say this is a waste of resources, we're going to put it into education and to public health care. And they have a 99% voter turnout rate. They have an extremely high literacy rate, and they have public health care for all people. And you know, I rarely hear their name mentioned in public forums because they're such a small country like the Switzerland of Central America. But I wish positive role models could be examined, because they are out there and there are solutions, and the solution is is that transformation from a military economy to a people economy where people matter. And I guess the question I have is do you think that Costa Rica and the solutions that do exist and have been tried, the solutions of like in Bangladesh where it was pioneered, where loans to women, $50 loans to women through Oxfam America, with a 99% return rate on investment. These are positive examples of things that do work, and yet you always hear talk about the problems and not enough talk about the solutions. There is no forum for solutions, and how people get so pessimistic because they don't think there are any answers. They just see this darkness. And do you think there is a way to bring those solutions to light? That's my question.
Thank you. I'll just say one thing, which is I know Dr. Oscar Arias, the former Costa Rican president, and he, through his foundation, has been trying to convince leaders of other countries to adopt the Costa Rican model. And in terms of getting attention for that work, he's run into exactly the, what you pointed out,
You know, the editorial board of the New York Times will say, well, Costa Rica is a small country and it's an exception and so forth. So I think there's a kind of a bias in the media about telling positive stories, you know, against it. And also, I think we have to create a climate where those examples can thrive, because there's been many countries that have tried to implement changes, and those changes have been basically reversed by force. So I think we have to highlight the positive examples, but we also have to build a structure, movement, a consensus, so that when countries try to follow those examples, they're not thwarted by violent actors. I'm sure others on the panel have things to say also.
Well, yes, of course, Costa Rica is our model, and we would like to follow it. In fact, we had a big discussion in Indonesia on what to do with our military. But unfortunately, that tendency now is has been how do you call it, reversed because of the problems that we have with these conflict areas, which is unresolved because both the companies, the IMF, the World Bank, the US, the G8, does not support the Indonesian government to do so. So what's going on right now, after September 11, is that more military powers, we see, we are witnessing the rise of more military power. The US government, who already stopped their support to the Indonesian army, now is trying to reinstate the aid to the Indonesian army. So it's a very difficult situation where the geopolitics, the official development aid is tied into military operations, and it's tied into you know, corporate interests. So for instance, now the good governance that is campaigning by the companies and by the IMF and the World Bank is not the governance that is demanded by the people, but good governance to for the companies to invest, to compete in a free competition, to get information, to get protection by the government, to get guarantee by the government. It doesn't matter that the Indonesian government is paying $50 million to OPIC. Yeah, because of the failed investment, the investment, the power plant is investment in East Java involved Enron, you know, and we are now MIGA, the World Bank Insurance Company, now is going to get from the Indonesian government, the Indonesian people's money, another $50 million because Enron got political protection insurance from the U.S. government and from the American, the World Bank. And it's all tied to protections also from the Indonesian government to these companies. So it's a very difficult situation. I wish those, I am telling you now, the Indonesian people condemn the act of September 11. It's not true that it is the Indonesian people supported it. We condemn it because it brings a lot of problems. It hampered our transition into democracy. And it brings the military back into power. We managed to make them to kick them out of the politics in the last 3 years, but they are coming back.
Well, in Bangladesh, they found another solution for the military. We're actually exporting them. We are sending them out. We're exporting them in the sense that we are sending our military to be peacekeepers in other parts of the world. So we don't have the ambitious captains and majors anymore in the country vying for power. Hopefully they're doing something more useful in another part of the world. I do agree with you that I think we need to have a stronger alliance with the media. The media, as far as human rights is concerned, is a very important partner because they help to expose and disseminate, and now increasingly they are there on the ground even before the human rights groups can get there. So they have that responsibility, and they bring to the fore the violations. We've got to find a way of getting them to also focus on hope, on the hopeful situations. And I think that the real answer lies more and more indigenously, within empowering people to find their own solutions. And I think this is where the whole aid debate is so skewed, where solutions are still being imposed from outside. And if you look at experience, indigenous experiences, you will find that those societies where most progress has been made have been societies that have not received huge amounts of money, because money brings in corruption. We see that happening all the time. In Bangladesh, the worst thing that has happened is the discovery of large reserves of natural gas, because that has brought in the big companies as been doing deals with governments, money is flowing in, and all sorts of political violence is resulting from that. What did help was movements like the microcredit scheme, the Grameen Bank scheme. And what they did is another factor that we haven't mentioned this morning, maybe before I came here it was talked about, and that's the whole gender issue. What the microcredit scheme in Bangladesh has deliberately done, it's an Islamic society where women don't enjoy all the rights. It's very difficult culturally to overcome that. And what this Grameen Bank microcredit approach has done is that it has promoted, through its credit scheme, it has promoted the transfer of property from men to women. For example, when they loan, give the loan, they insist that the collateral be in the name of the woman. So if a poor farmer is borrowing money to buy a cow, the cow must belong to his wife or his daughter. Otherwise, they will not lend the money. So in that way, economic power is coming into the hands of women. It's a long way to go yet, but that has made a tremendous change. So I think it's indigenous solutions, empowerment, and flexibility. I don't think there's any one model that's going to fit anywhere else. So what we need is a way of exchanging experiences so that we can adapt and change and do what is most appropriate for us. And I think that's what has to be recognized, the participation of the people who are going to be most affected by the issues.
Yes, the next.
I think it's quite clear that the democracy of the people has been hijacked by the corporations. And United Nations, which is sort of we the peoples of the world, has become we the corporations of the world in some respect. And I think we have to, so to say, tame the corporations. There is no other way. With their financial power and their eternal life, till they declare bankruptcy, they are very powerful and very unreliable. And that's the kind of world we live in. And it's about time that we insist on sunset clauses in all corporate charters so that they can be brought to public light on all their human rights records, environmental records, and you name it. And perhaps it's not our place to suggest that we get a second house at United Nations where people are directly elected so that there can be somebody who can stand up and tell President Bush, you can't go on bombing one country after another. What have you got, 60 countries on the list? How many people does that represent in the world? I mean, it's ridiculous that just because United States happens to be what it is and President Bush happens to be the first unelected president of the United States, that he can go on doing these nonsense things. I mean, it's about time Americans take responsibility for their unelected president.
Yes.
And I would really like to remind people that I was here on September 11, and though so much has been said negatively about September 11, there have been some, collateral benefits of September 11. For example, United States has actually paid up its UN dues, which it has not I mean, it needed cooperation of the other countries, so it paid up its UN dues. I mean, it's look at that. Another one, if you like, though many countries haven't signed their Kyoto or ratified the Kyoto Agreement, their carbon consumption has gone down. People don't travel as much. There is actually a little blip in terms of global warming. It's slowing down. Now, I mean,
I'm not saying that.
Excuse me, a second.
Yes, I know. I want me to ask a question.
Well, you've raised a lot of good issues, and I want some other people also to get that chance. So
I'm sure you do. Well, the question to all of you is, what other collateral benefits have you noticed from September 11? Please tell me.
So that the panelists have more time. I think there's not a lot of collateral benefits from September 11th other than the ones the speaker mentioned. I think the bigger problem is the way it's been seized upon by the Bush administration, by corporations, to really advance their objectives. And I think we're just starting to get back onto the playing field to start get our points of view out there. And if we're able to do that and to point out that this strategy of militarization is not going to make the world safer, then maybe we can talk sometime in the future of there having been some positive fallout from that terrible event. But I think we're a long way from there now. In terms of strategies for change, I think different people are going to want to work along different lines. My experience in the anti-apartheid movement was the companies would much have preferred to just kind of do window dressing. They had a code of conduct to deal in South Africa and so forth, and we just wanted them out. And they didn't talk to us until we had enough power that they couldn't ignore it, and we were costing them money because we were taking money out of banks. Municipalities were not investing or buying from companies that were helping the apartheid regime and so forth. So I think whether you view it as reform or a revolution of the corporate structure, it's got to be based on a strategy that hits them where it hurts, which is at the bottom line. And that's the only way you're going to get, I think, any kind of change in those quarters. In terms of the impacts on the environment, I think that's really important because particularly the Bush administration are trying to sell these new wars as being kind of clean wars. And clearly that's absurd if you look at all the people who've been killed, innocent civilians, by the bombing. But of course, it's very hard to document that data. They're not going to let you in there, really, to make full reports and so forth. But the environmental effects are ongoing. And so I think the more we can get a handle on that, the more we can counter this notion that somehow they've, because of this technology they have, they've turned war into some sort of acceptable operation, which I certainly think it's not. And I think the environmental element of that might be one of our strongest arguments for people to understand that they can't buy into this war without end against terrorism, no matter how frightened they were by the actions of September 11th. Tom, do you haven't said anything yet to questions you want to?
Yeah, well, the one thing I'll say is that I think, I was in Beijing when September 11th happened, and obviously it was a very traumatic thing, and I think we're still reeling in terms of trying to understand it and understand the new world. But one thing that it did bring up, it's the reason why we're meeting here today, because Davos has moved here, and I think it brings up a very important challenge which hadn't been as emphasized as much in the movement around globalization. In my opinion, a fundamental part of the structure that we're opposing is really a form of state corporate capitalism. It's not free market capitalism. That's not how corporations operate. Boeing, which is America's largest exporter, has been historically totally dependent on military spending, which in the U.S. is now set to rise in the next 5 or 10 years to either $450 or $500 billion a year. Now, we're already responsible for roughly 33% of world military spending, which is about $800 billion. Now, think about redirecting that money towards peace and security and basically working in partnership with people in the global south around the world. The one thing I think that September 11th has done in a greater way is that it's put a historic challenge in face of citizens in the U.S. and the global justice movement. We have to deal with the fundamental structural machinery from which these policies come from. And you mentioned the environment. Yeah, the Pentagon has long been one of the biggest polluters because national security has been one of the most fundamental anti-democratic ideologies of this century. It has justified policies of secrecy. The example we gave that was given from Indonesia, perfect example. At the time of the Indonesian coup, the director of the CIA was a former Bechtel executive. Bechtel benefited enormously. I'm not talking about a conspiracy theory. I'm talking about how large corporations operate in conjunction with governments. We need a perestroika and a democratization in this country, joining with those people around the world. And if September 11th puts that on the agenda more, well, I think it's a challenge for all of us. We better get to it, because by and large, as we know, the effects of September 11th have been a total political disaster all around the world. And Bush has just launched another program of militarization, increased it, which is guns with no butter. Those guns are going to come at the expense of social programs in the U.S. around the world, and also be funded by these huge tax cuts. So if that's on the agenda in a way that more people know about it, that is one thing that we can take and increase the momentum of our movement.
Irene or Emmy, do you want to have asked any of those questions? Or?
Yeah, I think I totally agree with the friends from Sierra Club that the wars has destroyed a lot of the environment. And I think we need to document what is happening now during the Gulf War and now in Afghanistan. What kind of environmental damage that has taken place there? But about strategy, I am an outsider, but I would like to share my my concerns that this war rhetoric got wide support from the American people, and I'm really worried that this kind of misleading rhetoric will mislead the American people to believe that, you know, this war is really created by this kind of people, because they believe in a certain religion and they believe in, you know, that kind of stuff. And I don't know what to tell, but that is the, you know, for 7 days here, I've been here for 7 days, and listening to the repeating speech of the President Bush, and then saying, you know, we're gonna get them, and it's repeated again and repeated again and again. I feel like, you know, all my Indonesian friends said, we feel like this is, you know, during Suharto eras, where Suharto's speech was repeated again and again by the state-owned and controlled television. So I don't know how to tell you, but I'm really worried about that.
On the collateral benefits of 11 September, I think one of the benefits was a greater willingness to understand other parts of the world. If you walk into a bookstore in New York, you'd be amazed by the numbers of books on the Taliban and Afghanistan and so on. And so there is interest in what's happening outside the US, and I think that's always positive. I think there was a window of opportunity very early on, just after the tragedy. There was a window of opportunity there to put together international cooperation in a much more positive way to address those issues that were on the table before the 11th of September and that still remain on the table. Unfortunately, the more time goes by, the more I fear that that window of opportunity has been lost. I think there is another window of opportunity now opening up, and that is with the collapse of Enron. I think what the collapse of Enron has done, and I feel it there very much, and I'm somewhat amused because it's almost ironical, are the jitters there in the World Economic Forum, because they thought they had a stable, accountable, verifiable, non-vulnerable system in place, and suddenly they are exposed. They can't rely on accounting firms anymore. So I think that vulnerability always creates an opportunity. And that is an opportunity that we should not miss here, to point out to the corporate sector that their own systems, the very systems in which they had put their faith to pursue their own goals and objectives, is a flawed system. And I think we should focus on that. That is an opportunity that we should not miss by.
Thanks.